I'm going to tell you today about how Saturn tricked us all, because actually Saturn is a type 1A supernova waiting to happen. That's actually not true at all. But I hope to tell you, for a little bit of light relief, I'll tell you about the electrodynamics of Saturn's magnetosphere. It's not normally a light relief, but today maybe it'll be. I hope it'll be an interesting story, though. So, first, I'll tell you a little bit about the Cassini mission, a highly successful mission, whose data I've been using. Then I'll tell you about how we measure the rotation rates of giant planets, which is the problem that I've been considering recently. I'll tell you why Saturn makes this difficult, and how Cassini at first didn't really help at all and made things worse. Then I'll tell you what the solution is, and explain why Cassini eventually helped and came to the rescue. All right, so the Cassini mission is a joint NASA, ESA, and Italian Space Agency mission. It took 7 years to get to Saturn. I think it cost $3.5 billion, and eventually arrived there in 2004. Its primary mission is supposed to be about 4 years. It's going totally fine, so it'll probably be there for longer. Cassini is pretty big for a space probe. It's the size of a bus, so two of the items in this picture are to scale. Here's Cassini showing off its slew of instruments. It has 12 different instruments here. I'm usually interested in these four, which are the plasma and radio wave observations. Coming from an astrophysical background, it's pretty amazing how much data and how much precision there is about Saturn and about planets in general. It actually makes it quite difficult as a theorist to make up new theories. Okay, so Cassini has done all sorts of things with rings and moons and the atmosphere, landed a probe on Titan, discovered a new radiation belt. It's got a really good press office. But I don't have time to talk about that. So for now, I'll just talk about this one problem of giant planet rotation rates. So as far as I'm concerned, Cassini has given us a lot of information about Saturn's magnetosphere. And when I say magnetosphere, I mean that region of space around the planet that's dominated by the planet's magnetic field as opposed to the solar wind. And for Saturn, that extends out to about 25 Saturn radii. Okay, so when you're talking about Saturn, it's pretty useful to start by talking about Jupiter, because Jupiter is sort of its well-behaved cousin. So, how fast is Jupiter rotating? Well, first of all, what do we mean by how fast is it rotating? So it doesn't have any surface, it has strong winds, so if you watch clouds on Jupiter rotating, then the period you get for rotation will depend on the latitude you look at the planet at. But we have good reason to believe that deep down in the interior of the planet is in solid body rotation, and the magnetic field, which is generated down there somewhere, is strong enough that the whole planet is rotating somewhere deep down as a solid body. So then the magnetic field on the outside ought to act as a tracer of the rotation of the deep interior of the planet. So, in principle, all we have to do then is sit out here in a spacecraft and watch the magnetic field as Jupiter rotates. You can see that the strength will change with time, and you'll get a period that is the period of rotation of the interior of the planet. However, it's not always easy just to sit right outside a planet. So there's another proxy we use for the magnetic rotation rate, which is radio emission from the planet. So radio emission tends to come from fairly energetic electrons, and electrons, as we know, are tied to magnetic field lines. This is the synchrotron torus, just somewhere like here outside of Jupiter. You can see that it's aligned with the magnetic equator, so the amount of synchrotron radiation coming from Jupiter, and in fact its polarization, change with the same period as the rotation rate of the interior. So for Jupiter, this works totally fine, and the period of rotation of Jupiter is 9 hours, 55 minutes, 29.6854 seconds, which has been pretty much constant on average for the 50 years or so we've been able to measure it. Saturn, on the other hand, is not so cooperative. Just like Jupiter, it has no surface. It has strong zonal winds up to about half a kilometer per second. If you look at the winds, if you look at the clouds, then it's probably rotating once every 10 and a half hours or so, not so different from Jupiter. The trouble is we can't measure its magnetic period directly, because as far as we know, the axis of Saturn's magnetic field is aligned perfectly with its rotation axis, to within 0.2 degrees. So that's a whole other story why that might be the case. But if you sit outside Saturn in your spacecraft and watch the planet rotate, you won't get any change in the magnetic field strength, so you won't be able to measure the rotation period of the planet. However, the radio observations have been somewhat more successful with Saturn. I think the Pioneer spacecraft and then the Voyagers, sometimes around 1980, discovered that Saturn emits Saturn kilometric radiation, which is radio emission at kilometer wavelengths. And that's coming from fairly energetic electrons that are tied to magnetic field lines that connect to the planet at pretty high latitudes. So magnetic field lines that come out somewhere far, but then the emission is coming from somewhere in here close to the planet. And if you look at that radiation, then you see that it's pulsed. And it's not pulsed in the way that a pulsar is pulsed, but it's pulsed in the sense that there's a sector on the planet that rotates with about 10 and a half hour period, and every time it gets to 11 hours local time, here's the sun over here, it's rotating this way, 11 hours local time, it emits more radio rays than it did at any other time. So what we say is, okay, so we couldn't detect a magnetic anomaly there, but probably there is one that we just missed that's somewhere at high latitude here. And somehow, when that comes around facing the sun, interacts with the solar winds somewhere further out there or something, it produces this radiation. But the point is, we're saying, so it's connected with the magnetic field, so we can get the magnetic rotation period, the period of the interior of Saturn, from this. So Voyager measured that, 10 hours, 39 minutes, 24 seconds. The IAU accepted that as Saturn's period. And I think it's less dense, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so it's not anywhere near Einstein. It's not up in the...
No, it's I think it is lower density, yeah. Okay, so that was accepted as the IAU period. It's still officially the rotation period of Saturn, even though in 1997 it was shown that this rotation period is not constant. So you can't measure the SKR from the Earth, partly because kilometric radiation will never get through the ionosphere, and also because it's pretty dim. So between 1984 and 1997, the Ulysses spacecraft, which is a solar wind spacecraft, was able to look at the kilometric radiation and to measure the period over 3 years. And you can see here it changes by of order 1% on a timescale of order 1 year. It goes both up and down. And that tells you that it can't possibly be, this SKR period can't possibly be the rotation rate of the interior of Saturn. If it was, if you were speeding up the whole planet, doesn't sound like much, 1%, 10 minutes out of 10 and a half hours, but you'd have to give and take away 1% of the solar luminosity while that was happening. So it's just not possible. So we say, okay, so the SKR, I don't know what's producing it. Clearly it's not giving us a rotation period. Then Cassini got Saturn, measured yet again a different SKR period. Okay, the SKR is like telling us nothing anymore. But then interestingly, it was able to discover these magnetic perturbations that we hadn't been able to discover before. Previously, it looked like the field was completely axisymmetric. And from these perturbations, which are really small, they're of order nanoteslas, so that's 10 to the minus 5 Gauss compared with the field strength at the surface of Saturn, which is about 0.2 Gauss. They measured a period that was constant over the time of observation, 14 months, and it was 10 hours, 47 minutes. So the authors of this paper, which of course was published in Science, decided that this is the rotation rate of the interior of Saturn. That inside, in the interior field of Saturn, there's some small anomaly, and we're seeing that rotating, we're getting the magnetic signal from that, and we're getting the fundamental period of the planet. But it's not possible, because, so if you think about, if you have a dipole field, it drops off from the planet as 1 over r cubed, and if you have a higher multipole, it'll drop off faster with distance from the planet. These anomalies drop off approximately as 1 over distance from the planet. So it's not possible that they could be sourced by currents, by some little magnetic anomaly inside the planet somewhere. So it's not the field anomaly from inside the planet. Yes.
Is it on an inclined orbit?
It's sometimes on an inclined orbit. It's got like sort of these big petal diagrams where it keeps changing and gets kicks.
From various angles.
Yeah, it's basically been all over and will continue to go further and further. It uses Titan quite a lot to get kicks. Okay, so this was kind of a big controversy in the Saturn community. What now is the rotation rate of Saturn? Why are we getting this magnetic period that's different from the SKR period, and the SKR period seems to vary? What is going on? Okay, so some other really spectacular Cassini observations actually give us the answer. So Enceladus is the answer. Enceladus is only about 500 kilometers across. It's a small moon of Saturn. But Cassini discovered that it was venting pretty large quantities, 100 kilograms per second, of water, water vapor, and dust. In these pictures, you can see you're seeing forward scattering from dust that's about the same size as the wavelength of light. And these are false colors. So all this water is coming off of Enceladus. It's a whole other story as to why that's happening. But then it spreads out and it forms some sort of broad neutral torus at about 4 Saturn radii away from Saturn. So well outside of the rings, still well inside of the magnetosphere where we just worry about Saturn's magnetic field. And it forms this sort of thick torus of neutral water. So then, what happens to the water? Well, this is where things start to get interesting. Some of the water gets ionized. And as soon as things get ionized, you have to start worrying about electric and magnetic fields. And I'm not going to spare you the details of this because it's actually not as bad as you think it is. So what do the electric and magnetic fields look like in the vicinity of Saturn? All right, so you have this planet that's spinning. The planet's ionosphere is a pretty good electrical conductor. And what that means is it better not, in its rest frame, have any large electric fields, or you'd have large currents flowing, you'd have large J cross B forces, and things just wouldn't be in equilibrium. So you can approximate the electric field in the frame, in the frame that's rotating with the planet, is about zero. Then you have all these magnetic field lines attached to the planet. Magnetic field lines conduct really well along their length, so it's just like you've put copper wire out into the magnetosphere. So if you go into the, so they can't have any electric field along their length either, so then if you go into the frame that's rotating with the planet, you have no electric field on the planet, and all these copper wires map out into the magnetosphere so that the potential is constant. All through the magnetosphere, there's no electric field in that rotating frame. And if you go to any other frame, you can just use a Lorentz transform to find out what the electric field is. The electric field, for example, in the inertial frame that's not rotating, will be like V of rotation cross B divided by C. Okay, so we have a vertical in the equatorial plane where the material will be. We have a vertical magnetic field and a radially outwards electric field. So now, if we ionize this water, what happens to the water once it starts to feel these fields? Okay, so you ionize, say, a water molecule, make H2O plus or something, then it starts to feel the electromagnetic fields. And it does what all ions do when they feel magnetic fields. It gyrates around the field lines, but it doesn't do so purely in a circle because it feels an electric field. It's been created in the Keplerian frame, which, as far as we're concerned here, is not moving very fast at all relative to the planet's rotation. So here is its trajectory. It's spiraling right in the magnetic field. The magnetic field is into the board here. When it's at the bottom of its trajectory, it's feeling an inward force of V cross B from the magnetic field, and it's also feeling a force upwards due to the electric field. So it feels more force, more inwards force, more centripetal force at the bottom of its gyration here than it does at the top, where the electric field is opposed to the direction of the magnetic force. So in the end, what you end up with is this sort of helical pattern, and which is really just a circular motion, and superimposed on top of that is a drift, which takes the ion, into the field, that into the frame that has no electric field. So it drifts. Anytime the ion feels electric and magnetic fields, it'll drift so that its mean velocity is in the frame with no electric field. The electron feels the forces in the opposite direction but does the same thing. So what that means, practically, is that you put this plasma in, you ionize it from a Keplerian orbit, and what it does is it starts to co-rotate with the planet because that's the frame in which there's no electric field. Here's the planet rotating. Here's the plasma rotating at the same speed. Once every 10 and a half hours, it will rotate. Now, it's making circular motion. So in that rotating frame, there's a centrifugal force trying to push the plasma away from the planet. So something has to be keeping it in, making it make that circular motion. And what that is an azimuthal current. It flows in a ring. You have this J current. In the rotating frame, you have a force outwards, which is your centrifugal force. And you have a force inwards, which will be your current crossed with your magnetic field, which balances the centrifugal force. And this is an equilibrium situation. But it's not a stable equilibrium situation. And this is why. Okay, so here we are. We've got this ring current flowing. We have the J cross B balancing the centrifugal force in the rotating frame. It's a nice circle. And then we're going to make a little perturbation. We're going to take a little blob from this ring and pull it out a little distance. So we have to keep this blob co-rotating too, so we'd better have this J phi to balance against the centrifugal force in the rotating frame. But now the J phi can't just close in a loop around the planet. It has to close somewhere else. And what it does is it'll flow up the field lines towards the planet, flow through the ionosphere of the planet, and flow back down. Now, I said that the planet's ionosphere was a good conductor, but it's not a perfect conductor, which means that in order to have this current push through it, it's going to have a little bit of an electric field in that frame. So then you can map what the electric field is down these copper wires. There's no potential drop over these copper wires. So you have the same electric field down here in the plasma. So I told you how if you put an electric field across a plasma, what it'll do is drift so that it's in the zero electric field frame. And in this case, so it drifts with E, which is this way, cross B, which is downwards, which corresponds to outwards. So what this means is that if you start with this nice happy situation, you make a perturbation outwards, the electric field has to occur, and the ultimate result is that it's pushed further outwards, so it's unstable. So what does all this have to do with the SKR and the magnetic field of Saturn? So it depends on the scale you're taking, but for the one I'm going to, for M equals 1, it's about 10 days. So it's much slower than the rotation period of the planet.
And that depends really just on the magnetic field.
Yeah, it depends on how much mass you've got there and what the conductivity of the ionosphere is. Okay, so all this is relevant because I think that we can explain all these strange and confusing observations by proposing that there is a tongue in Saturn's magnetosphere. And what I mean by a tongue, so the referees didn't like this terminology. They said that that was entirely inappropriate. What I mean by a tongue is that we have N equals 1 mode convection. That is, we convect outwards, convect this plasma outwards only along one stream, one tongue. And that this tongue is steady. It's a rigid structure, so that if you go into the frame that's rotating with this plasma torus, the tongue just rotates as a rigid structure in that frame. And what that means is that anywhere in the magnetosphere that you are, you can sit anywhere, you can sit out here, it doesn't matter if the plasma is doing funny things inside the tongue, but the tongue's pattern frequency is constant, so that any signal you see out in the magnetosphere will appear with the frequency of rotation of this tongue, of the pattern.
In terms of the modes are unstable, is it the case that the longest wavelength is the one the most unstable?
No, it's shorter that are most unstable. Yeah. It's basically just like a really Taylor instability. It's like mediated by magnetic fields.
So why do you argue that?
Because this explains the observations.
The fastest growing mode are the short wavelength modes.
No, it's a serious problem. It's subject to current work, but it turns out that this does explain the observation.
In the Taylor case, the largest node, it ends up dominating too.
What have you done? This is linear theory, so.
Yeah, so it's linear theory for the growth, but then.
You can't answer it, but it's not that simple.
Yeah, the growth is linear.
Right.
Then people try to simulate these things on computers, on huge computer models, and it's actually really difficult to do convection on a computer. So the results are not exactly conclusive. But so what I'm proposing is that in the saturated state where everything is gone nonlinear, this M equals 1 mode is the dominant mode. I don't have a particularly good reason to support that, but that's what I'm going to say. Okay, so then, given these assumptions,
so with the time constant associated with how long you can fill up the ring, so I have my source, Enceladus.
Mm-hmm. Enceladus.
What's the time constant of resonance of the material in the ring?
What do you mean?
How many days or years worth of outgassing is in the ring?
About 10 days. So it's consistent with all the plasma being replenished every 10 days. So that is a consistency with this calculation. So then you take these assumptions, you then conserve mass, you conserve charge, that is you close the currents, and you conserve magnetic flux. Basically you're just saying the plasma is stuck to the magnetic field lines out here. And you get these following conclusions. I'm going to spare you from the actual calculations of these. So we find that this tongue, if it exists, ought to extend from where Enceladus is out to about 15 Saturn radii, at which point the solar wind becomes important, roughly, and starts to rip the plasma off the end and remove it. This tongue should narrow with distance from the planet. It should have a spiral shape. It should start to lag the rotation of the planet. Although the pattern speed remains constant, the plasma starts to lag the rotation of the planet because it just becomes more difficult to keep the plasma co-rotating as it gets further out. The outflow time should be about 10 days. As I mentioned, this pattern rotates with the inner torus. But then what is this frequency of the inner torus? So the chief thing that's slowing down this inner torus is the fact that it's connected with these magnetic field lines to the ionosphere, and the ionosphere keeps having to provide, by way of currents, angular momentum to the torus to speed it up so it's fast enough to keep rotating with the planet. What that means is the ionosphere gets slowed down a little bit. But it's frictionally coupled to the interior of the planet, which is rotating faster, and so there's some equilibrium situation where it turns out that the ionosphere should be rotating about 1% slower than the interior of the planet, which means that this whole torus, and hence this whole pattern, is rotating 1% slower than the interior of the planet. 1% is a good number, it should resonate with the observations. And what about the variation of this time scale? A variation of this delay. So Enceladus varies, the amount of mass it's putting out varies on a time scale of maybe a couple of weeks, a month, which is pretty quick. But it's giving out neutral material, and the ionosphere and all the rest can't feel that until it gets ionized, but the ionization time scale is pretty long, it's about 1 year. So we'd only expect this delay to vary on a time scale of about 1 year.
Small fraction of all that material that gets ionized, and if it's replenished every 10 days and it's gone, the energy is back up in here, and it's only 10 to 2%.
Yes, yeah. In Saturn's magnetosphere, it's largely neutral material. Yeah. The neutrals get lost in a different way. Yeah, so this is a minor component of the loss of mass from of the mass from Enceladus escaping from Saturn. Okay. So how does this relate to the observations? Right, so I mentioned that you have all these currents flowing in the tongue, keeping the material in co-rotation. And because the centrifugal force gets largest towards the end of the tongue, the currents are largest towards the end of the tongue. These huge currents are closing by connecting with the planet. Right at the end of the tongue, you've got about 1 million amps flowing from the planet to the rings. That is, you'll have electrons flowing in the other direction. And they're flowing from only the narrow part of the very end of the tongue into the planet, which means that one little narrow part of the planet, one small longitude sector, is selected to have this huge current flowing into it. And if you have a large current flowing into one part of the planet, it doesn't take much to have some unstable electron distribution, and you end up with some coherent cyclotron emission. And it seems perfectly reasonable that that's what's producing this SKR. As for the magnetic perturbations, you've got 1 million amps flowing here. What's the typical magnetic perturbation anywhere else in the magnetosphere from that? It turns out to be of the order of 1 nanotesla and decreases approximately as 1 over distance from the planet, if you just consider this like a wire carrying 1 million amps. So this looks good. The right size of magnetic perturbation. We've shown why a narrow region of the planet would be selected for something unstable to happen with respect to radio emission. It's important to note that in this model, we've assumed that the magnetic and SKR periods, or at least we can only explain the magnetic and SKR periods, they're the same. So just to summarize, we assume these are actually the same, even though they weren't observed to be the same. They were observed by different groups. We require an N=1 outflow mode, a tongue that is a rigid structure in the rotating frame of the plasma. We simply do some physics, conserve these things, and we get the correct rotation frequency for the pattern for the tongue, the correct time scale for variation, the correct size of magnetic perturbations, and an explanation for why the SKR sector should be selected. Yeah, in like 3 slides. Yeah, I'll be done, and that'll be like the last slide. Okay, the referee said no, and then they said no again, and like 5 times. Then Cassini saved us. So Cassini's made lots of observations over years of the period of the SKR, and they've shown recently that actually the SKR, this is the period measured of the SKR, the function of time. This is where the magnetic perturbations were measured, and this is the error box of magnetic perturbations. And statistically speaking, the periods are actually equal. And the reason why the magnetic perturbation people found a constant period was because their statistical algorithm searched for a constant period. It's not possible they could have found anything else. So it turns out that assumption, that's completely fine. And then the really great thing was that Cassini found this plasma tongue. So actually, this just appeared in Science. The Cassini observations just appeared in Science like a couple of weeks ago, maybe. So previous measurements didn't find any evidence for a tongue. But that's because they were looking in the wrong frame. They were looking in the IAU reference frame for the rotation of Saturn. So if you then move into the frame that's rotating with the SKR frequency, you find a tongue. Here's the longitude relative to the SKR active sector. Here's the electron density. These are in situ electron measurements. And there's a broad sinusoidal distribution. That looks like a tongue to me. Also, the plasma density agrees with our rough calculations of how dense we expect the plasma to be as a function of distance, given how much is released. Here's the thing about the phases. This is what you've got here. You've got the tongue enhancement somewhere here, near to the planet. It hasn't been measured further out. At some pretty large angle with respect to that is the SKR emission sector. This is not in contradiction with our model, because we do expect the tongue has a spiral structure and lags behind where the plasma is near to the planet and is narrow at the end here. Right now, we can mess with the uncertain parameters to get this to fit. It would be nice to get something slightly better than that. In here. No. These were, so because the density is higher in there, it's easier to measure. And they were measured for about 3 to 5 Saturn radii. We expect the end of the tongue to be somewhere like 15. And I've been told that it's not inconceivable that there could be more tongue here and they just wouldn't have seen it. All right, so eventually it worked. The paper got published finally. But instead of looking like we predicted that this thing was here, it looks like we're just sort of justifying it afterwards. But what can you do? Yes. But these people never read AstroPH, the ones who care. But it's there. Except for the journal. JGR, the Journal of Geophysical Research, doesn't actually let you submit things to AstroPH, so I'm trying to be quiet about the fact that it's on AstroPH. So don't tell anyone. Yeah, it's almost published. All right. It's not quite the end, because I haven't told you yet how long the day is on Saturn. And in fact, you can't tell from this directly. But you could wait until such point when there's not very much plasma in the atmosphere, and so probably the ionosphere won't have been slowed down too much. And that's probably as close as you're going to get to a measurement of the length of the day on Saturn. It's shorter than any of the periods that they've measured so far, I can say that. Also then, there are issues with the physics. There are things like, why is the main mode M equals 1? And there's problems with why the plasma temperature, even though you have an expanding gas, is increasing with distance. These are things I'm working on for now.
Could we matter that the ionosphere
speed up again? Yeah. The sort of frictional coupling timescale between the ionosphere and the interior of the planet is about a day, so it won't take long. Okay, so this problem is almost solved, but what about those supernovae? Thank you. The instability mechanism, it's not a new instability mechanism. It's actually relatively well known, because it seems to happen at Jupiter. All we said basically was, if you did have the M equals 1 mode and it was dominant, then all the scales work out that this would explain these strange observations that you're getting. So it's not inventing magical new physics. No, but it's saying that it's there, and nobody knew that it was there, and they said it wasn't there, and that this is what's producing the magnetic periods. I mean, it's a small discovery, right? It's a small thing, but I have to be happy with what I can do.
I think what he's saying is, it the case that the origin of the tongue have anything to do with that instability?
It's It's possible that it doesn't, but...
So I'm still trying to understand the phase of it. So it doesn't relate to the planet, the location of the source? But could it be drifting on the orbital period of that source?
No.
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 So it's known that the end equals the location of the end equals time.
It's rotating...
That is sort of random. This is symmetry breaking. It doesn't have anything to do with the location.
Nothing to do with Enceladus, yeah. Yeah. It's rotating with the SKR period, which is much faster than the orbital speed of Enceladus.
Right, but I guess I'm asking, could it be related? So what's the orbital period of Enceladus?
So it's a four. It's not, it's of the order of days, like 4 days or something. Yeah.
So you're not seeing the sun change its location?
No. It is hard to understand why you'd have this one stable tongue that's not the most unstable mode, probably, that but the pattern is stable for so long, 30 years. It's really difficult to understand why that would be the case.
So you mentioned right at the end that Jupiter has Io and a sodium cloud. And do you see this? Same thing, or is Jupiter more complicated?
No, so Jupiter is not that complicated. The rotational modulation in Jupiter, as I showed, is sort of dominated by the fact that the dipole is tilted in Jupiter. And it is believed that plasma escapes from Jupiter via this same instability, but no large-scale tongue like this has been observed at Jupiter, except I think maybe it's there. Because there are some mystery periods at Jupiter that are slightly slower than the rotation period and seem to vary on the timescale of years. And I'd like to try and explain that in terms of something similar, but they won't like that either.
Would you make your case even stronger if you could make under the heat? Like, would you expect any auroral effects where it is 1 mega and...
Well, that's the SKR. That's this kilometric radiation, that's the auroral effect.
You don't expect to see that in radio. Like in Jupiter, where the ionosphere, where it connects, where the footprint is on Jupiter itself, you see these nice footprints of the aurora going around.
I don't think that there's any optical emission associated with the SKR.
Can you also predict that there's no other moon around Saturn that shows this outgassing like in other stars, because you don't see any other periods? You would expect the same thing.
Well, you wouldn't expect, so if you looked at, say, the plasma density as a function of radius, you would expect to see some sort of bump coming in. You would expect, I mean, if you have this sort of global mode happening, then maybe if you had some other plasma source somewhere, the global mode might have a slightly different shape or be a slightly different frequency. But those are the things we can't entirely explain right now. But it's certainly something you could detect if you looked at the plasma density as a function of distance. Yes. Yeah. There are ideas to explain why. There's this idea that Dave Stevenson had maybe about 20 or 30 years ago to explain this, that you have some sort of conducting shell surrounding wherever the dynamo is producing the magnetic field, and because it takes some time for magnetic field to diffuse, for a magnetic perturbation to diffuse through a conducting shell, you can sort of shield out, you can screen out any perturbations. But you know, you can't answer why doesn't that happen at Jupiter and so on.
It could be just a coincidence. The Cowling method, Cowling theory says that it should not be aligned.
Right.
But, yeah, they drift, and so it could be just a coincidence.
But it's just happening right now?
Yeah.
Do you need a solid core to actually anchor the magnetic field? Or can it also, I mean, you see orientation of the magnetic field constant with its
It's allowed to be a liquid. It's just, it's a conducting material. The important thing is that it's highly conducting, and we do expect it to be rigidly rotating at some depth. So it behaves kind of like a solid, but it doesn't have to be a solid. It's just a rigidly rotating.
Can you keep a line, a field in a rigidly rotating?
Yeah. Look at Jupiter. Oh yeah, but I don't think the actual solid is the important part. All right.